This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Who's there?
Oh, sorry. Is Andrew there?
First base. What's happening?
Hey, my name's Craig. I have a podcast I'd love to tell you about. Do you have?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We don't need any.
No, but it's like a pod. Do you know what a podcast is?
Close the door.
Okay, oh no!
Imagine an AM door closing noise in your
bunk. You've got mail. My name's Craig. Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read.
My name's Andrew, and that skit felt pretty bad.
Yeah, I've been knocking a lot of doors lately. We had a local election here in Philadelphia. I got involved like you do. We're going to talk about Drowning Ruth by Christina Schwartz in just a little bit. I had someone come and was thankful to talk to me about politics because I was not trying to sell them power or cable the other day.
Man, there are so many people who come to my house just trying to sell me cable and power.
Power cables. Cable
it's
power.
mostly power. It's yes. Always power. And as with many customer service interactions, you just have to find like the secret phrase that gets them to go away. And mine is to very firmly say the power company that we already use and that we're happy and goodbye. So little life hack from me to you. Thing I was thinking about talking about is I was at a wedding this past weekend.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm done.
And there were bartenders there for an hour. And then I turned around and the bartenders were gone and people were just serving themselves drinks. Ooh. Because they only had to have the bartenders there for the first hour.
Oh.
And so all of a sudden, all the cups got big and all the drinks got bad.
Were you tipping each other?
No, there was no tipping.
That's
there was
poor
only, there
etiquette.
Was only destruction. If you had had any of these drinks, you would not tip for them either.
Ew, no. Who was responsible? No one was responsible
just boys,
is the answer.
Just muscle boys.
Oh,
beautiful
no.
Drunk muscle boys at this wedding serving everybody very strong drinks. So we both had eventful weekends.
Yeah, you know, and we're coming up on another eventful weekend. So we're recording this in the middle of the week. Feels kind of weird, but we're going to get through it together, you know.
Mm-hmm. Wait, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Can I use your phone?
Oh, no. What happened to you?
My car.
Is it okay?
Got stolen.
It's really what I learned when I was learning how to canvas was to speak in terrifyingly halting sentences. It really leaves room for the other person to talk, but it stops them from getting anything like out and across to you. So it's really good. It's a good way to meet your neighbors. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and to learn improv. It's really
good. It's true. So we talk about a book every week. One of us reads it, tells the other person about it.
What did you read?
I read Drowning Ruth by Christina Schwartz. It was a Patreon recommendation for us by Jennifer. Thank you, Jennifer. You can go to patreon.com/overduepod to find out more information about how to do that. I did double check to see if Jennifer had any specific notes about the book. She did not, but she sent us a Facebook message, like just begging us to read it. And then a couple months later, subscribed to the Patreon and begged us to read it. So,
okay,
strong
so
feelings.
Really interested. Yeah. I'd never heard of this book or of Schwartz.
I had not.
I did
either.
Do a little research. So this was. We'll talk about this in a minute.
Oh, sure.
But this was a Oprah Book Club selection when it was published in late 2000.
I believe that my Kindle edition is called Drowning Ruth parentheses Oprah's Book Club close parentheses. So
yeah, when you get that sweet endorsement, you just write it forever. You write it for life.
Truth.
So she's written 5 novels. She was born in Wisconsin, and she now lives in either California or New Hampshire, depending on which author bio you're reading.
Okay.
Drowning Ruth is by far her best known book. If you're going by Goodreads ratings as a metric of popularity, it's got 76,000 compared to 2,000 for 2013's Edge of the Earth, which is the next most popular one.
Yeah, it was a bestseller, and I don't know, like, I mean, obviously got picked up by Oprah. I know Wes Craven optioned it for a film at one point that never got made.
It was supposed to be a movie. The Wikipedia simply says that, like, it may be made into a movie, or like someone's making it into a movie, and there's no citation on that. And so I go to Google and I'm typing in Drowning Ruth movie, and the first thing that comes up that's actually about the movie was published in October of 2000, which is about a month after the book had come out and gotten this Oprah Book Club endorsement.
Yeah.
And Gillian Flynn, writing for Entertainment Weekly. That's right.
Whoa.
The Gillian Flynn.
Was there a weird twist in the middle of the article?
Writing for The Entertainment Weekly. No. Unless the twist is that ultimately the movie did not end up being made.
Ben Affleck, how could you do this to me?
So that's what I've got.
I saw an IGN article about it because it was Wes Craven. So all the nerds were, I guess, excited about this. Yeah, horror maven Wes Craven.
Remember when all the video game sites became Marvel and Star Wars fan sites overnight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If aliens ever find our internet, they're going to be really confused by the mid-20-teens and what happened. But yeah, this... I didn't find anything else about Schwartz except that she, as you said, is from Wisconsin, and that factors into this book. It's set in the early 20th century in Waukesha County. My brain is broken. And it's like a lake town up there. Mm-hmm. But you wanted to talk about Oprah's book club.
I thought maybe we should.
How about that?
But it turns out that it was pretty interesting. So we have read a bunch of Oprah Book Club books.
Mm-hmm.
We've read a total of six,
as far
as I can tell. So we read Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines.
Yeah.
Drowning Ruth by Christina Schwartz, this one. 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. And then for Book Club 2.0, which I'll talk about in a minute, we've read Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead and Behold the Dreamers by Imbolo Mbwe. Fun fact that I found out, and maybe I found this out already during our Secret episode and just forgot, but The Secret was not an Oprah Book Club book.
Whoa.
It just was a book that was talked about on Oprah.
Oh, it didn't make the cut.
And Oprah subscribes to its worldview, but no, it was never an Oprah Book Club book.
Oh, dang. How do you feel
about that?
Yeah,
as far as I could tell from the list, the original Oprah Book Club, which was on the TV show, it recommended around 70 books between September of 1996 and December of 2010.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's because it started out as a more or less monthly thing.
Mm.
And then she took a hiatus in 2002 because she didn't feel like she could keep up with it anymore. And then when it was brought back in 2003, it was a lot. It was a lot rarer. Like most years after that have somewhere between 2 and 4.
Hmm.
And like 2006 and 2008 only had one book each. And then the last selections for Book Club 1.0 were Great Expectations and A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
What?
So that feels a bit like a cop out. I don't know.
Come on.
And then Oprah's Book Club 2.0 was announced in 2012. And between then and December 2018, which is the most recent recommendation, she recommended the Michelle Obama book.
Oh, sure.
Becoming.
Yep.
That's recommended another 10 books.
Now, are those getting out? Because she doesn't have a show anymore. She has the own network.
It's a joint venture between the O Network, the Oprah Magazine, and then like various social media presences.
Okay, sure.
I can also tell you that like the Apple ebook store and Amazon both have like Oprah Book Club specific landing pages. So clearly she has a lot of deals with like retailers.
Yeah, yeah.
Keeping this going. And when people do get recommended by the Oprah Book Club, they still see it's still got that power. And then the most recent news in March, this past March, Apple announced that it was starting a big TV service, and it just showed us a bunch of people that cost a lot of money, but it didn't show us any names of any shows or any clips or anything. It seems very early.
Okay.
But some version of the TV Oprah Book Club is coming to Apple's TV service in the question mark.
So some...
Yeah.
Like, authors, I guess, for the Apple network. Yeah.
And it's not clear how often it's going to come out.
Yeah.
It's not clear how long it's going to be. Nothing about it is clear because, I don't know, Apple just spent a lot of money and doesn't have anything to show for it yet.
Yeah. Okay. Neat.
There's one paper, actually, that says that in aggregate, book sales, particularly of genre fiction like mysteries and romances, dropped by a statistically significant 2.5%. in the weeks after a new book club selection would come out because people were taking so long to read these big books that Oprah was recommending.
Whoa. That's interesting.
And listen, whether that paper is peer reviewed or not, I don't know, but I did
No one had time to peer review it because they were reading the latest O book.
They were reading the latest Oprah book. I don't want to make any kind of value judgment about the Oprah Book Club. People have in the past, most notably Jonathan Franzen.
Yeah.
Who had a book, and it's escaping my mind right now, but one of his books in like 2001 was recommended, and he had a bunch of stuff to say in various interviews. In one, he says, "I see this as my book, my creation, and I didn't want that logo of corporate ownership on it." The extremely salty Blogspot blog that I found that collected all these quotes together was like, "Well, I guess he didn't mind the corporate logo of his publisher."
Got him.
And then he was talking to Terry Gross. "So much of reading is sustained in this country, I think, by the fact that women read while men are off golfing or watching football on TV or playing with their flight simulator or whatever."
What?
The three male activities. "I had some hope of actually reaching a male audience, and I've heard more than one reader in signing lines now at bookstores say, if I hadn't heard you, I would have been put off by the fact that it's an Oprah pick. I figure those books are for women. I would never touch it. Those are male readers speaking." So what about the men? Why aren't the men reading, Craig?
So this is from an interview with The Atlantic that Schwartz did in 2002 or so when her second book, All Is Vanity, came out. They asked her about the being picked by Oprah thing. And first she was just like, "This is super exciting. I can't believe this is happening." And this is what she says. "In a couple of radio interviews, people asked me essentially whether I was sorry that Oprah had picked my book because it slotted Drowning Ruth into this category of a, quote, woman's book. I guess I had two reactions to that. First of all, I like having a lot of women readers, and if that makes my novel a woman's book, I like having written one. And also, I have to admit, I do know people who would have snobbishly said, 'I will not read an Oprah book,' before mine became one. And then if they were friends, of course, they said, 'Oh, well, I must have been wrong.' But clearly those people have very little sense of the books Oprah has chosen." And then she goes on to mention like Toni Morrison. This was several years before Oprah picked The Road by Cormac McCarthy as an Oprah's book club book.
And it's such a girly book, too.
It's such a girly book, that post-apocalyptic nonsense violence book. I think overall, like most of the things Oprah has done, they have a net positive effect. I say most because of The Secret. But
The Secret is not an Oprah Book Club selection.
Yes.
So don't malign the Oprah Book Club.
The Nintendo seal of approval holds. It's weird.
There are books on it, and I think this one might be one of them, but there are books on it that are a little lighter, that are mostly about like themes of sisterhood or motherhood or whatever, that probably would not be perceived as like serious literature by the mostly white, mostly dudes who decide these things.
Yeah.
But to judge the entire collection of Oprah Book Club picks based on those books kind of does it a disservice. And yeah, there is some dated stuff on it. There's like three Bill Cosby books on this list.
Ooh.
All from like 1996 and 1997, but yeah, some of them don't age as well as others. But even in just the ones that we've read, like there are a lot of different perspectives throughout a lot of different eras, like Middlesex, The 100 Years of Solitude, Underground Railroad, Behold the Dreamers. Those are all dealing with different like experiences of different people through like vastly different lenses.
Yeah.
And yeah, if Oprah's book club is making people read that stuff along with the lighter stuff, then yeah, I think that's fine.
Yeah, I think it's probably fine.
We approve of it, which means it's fine.
Well, that's it. Finally, people can use Oprah's book club list because we said it's okay.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about this book, Andrew, but first, let's take a quick break.
Whew, I could use one. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Hey, it's me, a salesman from Quip, the electric toothbrush company.
Whoa, welcome to my house. What do you got in that briefcase there?
Are you looking for something to give to your dad or celebrate your new grad?
I've got both of those. They
need
stuff.
Do you have and love your dads and grads?
I do, Mr. Salesman that I've never met before.
Well, then you're just going to love Quip. It's an electric toothbrush that offers sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums and also the gums of your dad or grad.
Good. They do have nasty gums.
It's got a built-in two-minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and help you clean your whole mouth evenly. It's also got a cool multi-use cover that you can stick on the mirror for at home or pop it off and put on your toothbrush for traveling. And brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5.
Hey, Mr. Salesman, this all sounds good, but have you ever used Quip?
I have. I've been a dad. I've been a grad. I've been sad. I've been mad. And regardless of which one of those things I was, Quip got my mouth super clean. And I really like having new brush heads every 3 months. So that's why I love Quip. That's why over 1 million happy, healthy mouths do too. And if you want to get in on this action, Quip starts at just $25, and you can go to getquip.com/overdue right now and get your first refill pack for free. That's a $5 value. Your first refill pack free at getquip.com/overdue.
Okay, get out of my house. I'm going to go use the internet.
All right, bye. Knock, knock.
We're doing it again. Who's there?
Knock, knock, knock.
Come on in.
It's me, the podcast man, and I've come to take your podcast.
Where are you taking it?
It's not important. Please tell me, speak into my can and fill it up with podcast, and I'm going to take it with me.
Okay, Mr.
To Apple and put it up on iTunes.
Okay. Do I retain any of my rights?
No, just talk into the can, please.
Okay. Mr. Podcast Man, I'm doing this under duress, but I will tell you about Drowning Ruth by Christina Schwartz.
Thank you.
All right. So this is, I think this book is three things. I mean, it is first and foremost, it is a book. But the three things that the book is...
Wait, is three things on top of being a book?
Yeah, sorry.
Would you count that as a fourth thing?
That might be the hidden fourth thing if you get to the last level, you find out it's a book.
Okay.
It is historical fiction, sort of. We'll come back to that. It is a mystery / melodrama. And it's a book about like sisters and moms and stuff. Those are like the three main things that it's doing.
Okay.
In the back of the book, there's a little afterword from Schwartz where she actually says, but you wouldn't call it a historical novel, quote, only that its setting is in the past, and I hope my characters think and behave in a way that's appropriate to their time and not to ours. I needed to set the story in an era in which Amanda, who's the main character, could do something that she and her community would find shameful, but that would not make her monstrous. We'll get into what that is. I think she's drawing a line between historical fiction, which we've talked about before, that is like explicitly engaging with historical events or like real people that existed, and this just happens to be set from World War One to World War Two in Wisconsin, and like things from that era like certainly have tangible effects in the world, but it is not like the years where it's in the Depression, like we get a couple lines about it. And it certainly impacts the characters, but I can see why she isn't like, oh, I'm writing a book that's just exploring this era, you know?
Sure. What do you think? What do you think the difference is? Cause it seems like it would be hard to tell. I think maybe a historical book is more about interacting with things that happened in the time and the effect that they have on people, or what it was like to observe those things.
Yeah, this, it doesn't feel like she is trying to ask questions about the era or ask specific questions about women in the era. What she just said, so Amanda's secret involves her getting pregnant by a man on a, on like a one night stand, and this is in the 20s or 30s when this happens.
Okay, so if this is happening now, it would be the basis for a hilarious Amazon TV show.
Very likely, yes.
But then probably not so great. Not societally,
not
speaking.
So great. No, and I think also in the afterword, she tells a story about like the initial impulse for the novel was like some woman in her neighborhood that she remembered who was like a recluse, who was kind of a Boo Radley-esque character where no one knew why she was like shut up in her house all the time. And she started trying to imagine like who this person was and why they might be that way. And none of the characters are quite to the extreme of a Boo Radley, but they are certainly like eccentric and have their foibles.
Are they in some way like cut off from the rest of the community, or that seems essential to Boo Radley's Boo Radley-ness?
So it is set in a lake town on what I the lake is Nagawaki, and I don't know if that's a real lake or not. She says she based it on some other places, so it leads me to believe it is not necessarily real. But and the main characters, Amanda and her sister Maddie and Maddie's daughter Ruth, for a period of time live on a small island that is on the family farm's property on the lake. Okay. Are you finding out if it's a real lake right now?
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
I can if you want, though.
No, that's okay.
How do you spell it?
N-A-G-A-W-A-U-K-E-E. Nagawaki.
Right, there is a war memorial.
Okay, so maybe it is sort of real.
There's a park.
Great. Okay. I didn't know. I thought it was a fake place.
Like a golf course. Yeah. Well, I don't know that it's a lake, but
okay. But it's set in this area of the country that is like a mix of farmland and budding Chicago like summer house territory. Actually, the guy that Amanda sleeps with, Clement Owens, he's an ideas man, which feels very early 20th century. He has lots of ideas for gadgets, including a thing called a vacuum box for cleaning your medical equipment.
Wait.
Yeah.
Huh?
It never happens. And I tried to Google it to see if it was a real thing and couldn't really find anything, which led me to believe it never happened. Like, all right. You put all your tools in this box that creates like an actual atmospheric vacuum. That's supposed to...
And it just sucks them clean?
Yeah,
or
like
what?
Kills all the bacteria or something
what?
In there.
Okay, that's... I don't know.
And he's like trying to make that go like he's like, you know, some sort of infomercial man, and it doesn't take off. But he does have some money, and part of what... After he has this very brief relationship with Amanda, that kind of sets her life on a painful direction. He has heard of the town where she's from, and he goes up there with his money and like buys up a bunch of tracts of land, which he then like resells to people so that they can build their estates on it and stuff. So all of that feels kind of early 20th century, like pushing through the end of the Gilded Age, rich people gonna rich people in this kind of lower income farm town. And then the farms get hit by the Depression. So I'm going through the ways in which like the real world history affects the events of the book and the setting of the book. Carl, who is Amanda's brother-in-law, he is off in World War I. He got married to Amanda's sister Maddie after they were only dating for like a few months. They didn't really know each other super well, and he was kind of feeling maybe a little restless in the marriage, and he decided to enlist. Whether or not he could have maybe gotten some sort of like medical exception, who knows? Mm-hmm. And Maddie was very upset with him for doing such a thing, but he went anyway. Maybe he didn't have a choice because it was World War One. And at the beginning of the book, Amanda is returning to this town having had a bit of a nervous breakdown, which you later discover was not long after she had this evening with Clement Owens. And she is returning home away from her job as a nurse to spend some time with her sister on the family farm and kind of recuperate while, you know, Carl is away in World War One, and he is injured and he's going to come home. And on just before he gets there, something happens. You don't know what it is, but Maddie disappears and then is later found dead, having drowned.
Oh, yikes.
And that gets us.
That's very Lovecraftian, actually.
Yeah. What?
It's just a mystery. You just, it turns up drowned. You never know why.
Well, you do. I mean,
what out there? What creeps in the night? You know,
if what goes bump in the night, indeed. Mm-hmm. And that builds into like the second part of the book that I talked about, which is like the central mystery is there was an evening where Amanda, Ruth, and Maddie were together on this island, like living in this little like lake island shack kind of thing, and something happened this winter evening where Maddie disappeared. Ruth was too young to really understand what was going on. And then Maddie was found drowned. And the only scene that we get at the beginning of the book is Amanda like talking to someone in town about her sister being gone, and mm-hmm. then like going back into her house and like wiping, like washing her hands, and there's like blood on them, and they're like her thumb has been like hurt somehow. Ugh. And you don't really know what is going on.
It sounds like Schwartz is trying to like recreate what it feels like to be traumatized. Like you would become a fairly unreliable narrator. Yeah. In that circumstance.
Yeah. The initial like plot point that Amanda was coming back because she had to spend some time like in an institution opens up all sorts of unreliability from Amanda, and like what is she capable of, what doesn't the reader know about her, and all of that kind of plays into the central mystery of the book.
It is a mystery thing, like you're reading to find out what happens at the end.
I
you know what I mean? Like, I'm not just saying in the sense that you read through every book in a linear way and then you find out what happens at the end. I mean, like, the point is for it to be some kind of a mysterious page-turnery kind of thing.
So, yes, it's not as explicit in that there is not a, like, there's not a detective at the heart of it. For the most part, the matter is considered, like, closed. Like, something, Maddie fell under the ice and drowned. Like, that is the explanation that the town takes. It's not until later in the book that anyone else has any other suspicions. The book is structured in such a way that there are a bunch of time jumps and a bunch of perspective shifts that keep the reader from getting a real good handle on what's going on. And that is the way that she like propels you forward to like, oh, what could have happened? What did happen? Every once in a while, she will move from like a near third person to a like first person passage, and it'll have like a little, like it'll say the character's name above it. And then all of a sudden you're just in Amanda's head, or you're in Ruth's head or something.
And what are those different perspectives doing? Like, why do we switch into first person?
It's usually to give you as little objective information as possible. So like,
oh, got it. Okay.
There are some early on when Ruth is still like a little kid. So the language is more, it's simpler.
Yeah.
It's more childlike. And so like Ruth, when she's a little girl, like accepts this version of events where, yeah, her mom left and maybe, you know, she went to heaven and maybe we'll get to see her someday. But also Ruth drowned too. And the way that she says that, you never really know what the heck she means, and she doesn't even seem to really know what she means because it's a story that's been told to her. But you can tell by the way it's deployed in those POV chapters that it's important, and you're gonna get an answer about it later.
Okay.
So that is one of the like stylistic choices that I think I will remember about this book, and folks who were like chiming in when we put it on the schedule who were like excited about it. That's probably a thing that folks take away from it, is the structure of it. And the big wrinkle in the like mystery plot is after Carl comes home, and like the first third of the book, I thought it was just going to be like Amanda and Carl having to raise young Ruth, who is kind of going a little wild child on them after her mom has died, and like doesn't want to speak and doesn't want to listen to anybody. Amanda actually has kind of like a relapse and has to spend some more time in a hospital by herself. And Carl is trying to raise his daughter, whose mother he barely knew. And the daughter had barely, I don't even know if she'd been born before he left to go to war. So he's trying to navigate that relationship.
So I had suggested that this might perhaps be a lighter book about sisterhood and stuff based on how you described it to me. And what I'm hearing from all the stuff you're saying is no.
No. It is
I'm getting a no.
Getting a no, perhaps. What it does have some melodrama to it, because the stakes for Amanda throughout the entire book are extremely high, because she has like two big secrets that we are gonna find out about by the end of the book. One is what did happen to Maddie, and two is what else happened to her. Like what the what happened to Maddie has other ramifications for things that happened in Amanda's life when she is pregnant with Clement's kid after she slept with that guy. And that's revealed a little ways in, and you don't really know what the end result of that is, because it's chopped up as we jump through time.
Sure.
But like the first half of the book, I didn't expect it to get that heavy. I thought it was like, okay, yeah, Maddie's dead, but like now we're in a period piece where we're like dealing with this like kind of broken family, and we're just going to kind of see them through the other side, maybe.
Sure, but no.
No, I mean, we do even jump to one of my favorite parts of the book, actually, is it almost feels like a chapter from Harper Lee. Like it feels like a To Kill a Mockingbird little short story where we do a time jump. Ruth was held out of school for a few years because Amanda didn't want to let her go. Now that she's lost Maddie, she doesn't want to let Ruth go. Mm-hmm. And finally, Ruth goes to school. So she's a little older than the other kids. She had also like had a terrible fall when she was younger. So she has this like kind of weird black tooth, like a baby tooth that's like completely discolored.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I bet all the kids are like super kind and chill to her.
They totally like love calling her Ruth the Tooth and stuff. And it's like really mean.
Just a real, like, real loving nickname that everybody feels good about.
And of course, there's like a young, like a popular girl, Imogene, who is initially like doesn't like Ruth at all or doesn't really care about her. And on a day where Imogene has decided to win a blue marble back from a jerk boy named Bert, she discovers that she sees Imogene, she sees Ruth rather playing with marbles by herself, and Ruth is like sick at them. She's super good at marbles.
Okay.
And so we get this little like self-contained story where Imogene recruits her to win back the marbles, like win back this fancy blue marble from Bert. And Bert is like, well, you need to put up some collateral for your teammate. I want her tooth because he's a creepo.
Yikes.
And you get the kind of cliched Ruth like tying a rope to her tooth and then like having Imogene slam a door.
I bet that it's probably more that the tooth fairy is nasty, right? Like the tooth fairy probably loves getting nasty, weird teeth and will give you extra money for it.
If they're covered in blood. That's what Bert wants.
Just talking about the black tooth.
Oh, yes. That's fair.
No, I mean the tooth fairy wants stuff clean. I mean, like,
but you want rare teeth.
You don't want the FDA or whoever it is who would be investigating.
Who regulates the tooth fairy? That's a good question.
That's a good question. I didn't know if it was OSHA because it's kind of a workplace thing, but she seems like more of a freelancer or maybe a remote worker.
Yeah, well, she's a small business owner
organization. Yeah,
I mean, if she's truly working on her own, and it's not a like there's multiple tooth fairies out there logging hours, like, is this a Santa situation?
I mean, it probably started with one tooth fairy, but then it became kind of a multi-level marketing scam.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who were trying to get me to become a tooth fairy on Facebook.
Yeah.
So they have to like rip.
Every Christmas, my cousin just gives me a big bag of teeth.
And if you give your friends five teeth and they all give their friends five teeth. So they do rip the tooth out of Ruth's mouth, and then Ruth stomps Bert at marbles, and then her and Imogene become best good friends.
Okay.
And they like they even do a like. They're bored one day, and Ruth is like, hey, you want to, like, it's the equivalent of, hey, want to see a dead body? And she's like, hey, you want to come to the graveyard where my mom is buried?
Yikes.
Like, cool.
That's spooky.
Cool, weird kid.
Cool, spooky.
And the thing you learn in that scene, Andrew, is that Imogene has the same birthday as Maddie's death day. And there's, like, a moment, and Ruth and Amanda both have reactions to Imogene that are very strong, and she reminds them of Maddie a lot. And you know it's important, but Schwartz does a pretty good job for most of the book of like not showing you why. You just know that you're supposed to be paying attention to this kind of stuff. And so then we get to some of the sister like relationship stuff where Ruth and Imogene have a similar friendship that is like a parallel to Amanda and Maddie's like sister friendship, where they're slightly apart in age, though I think Ruth and Imogene are a little bit closer, and they are invested in each other. They get jealous of each other. They fight. They measure themselves against each other. They also have like goals that they want to explore together. And it just feels kind of timeless that in like, yes, they are, you know, later when Ruth and Imogene are like, you know, late teens or I guess maybe even early 20s, they are like studying at a college to learn how to be, good secretaries because that's their best option. And then they're like, well, we'll learn how to do this.
That's the time that it is.
Yeah. And they're like, we'll learn how to do this, but then maybe we'll run off to Chicago and form like an ad agency because we'll be like smart business people or something like that.
Sure. I like that idea.
And within those like positive paths for their friendship, there's all these kind of undercurrents of Imogene is the popular pretty one and Ruth is the awkward, like weird one who's, you know, not conventionally attractive and doesn't think she is and has always kind of been different since her mom passed away. There is an interesting like class undercurrent to Imogene where her parents run the local like fish bait shop. And so when they're like going to like this dance in the late 30s, so it's a couple time jumps. And Ruth is like in the bathroom because she doesn't want to be out at the dance, and she hears two girls come in and they're kind of, you know, talking crap about Imogene, and they're referring to her perfume as Eau de Grub. I guess because it smells like fish bait, right?
But it probably doesn't. They probably found an insult and work backward to it.
Yeah, because it sounded good.
That's how kids work.
Yeah. So even Imogene has like a little bit of like she is trying hard at herself to kind of overcome some perceptions from those around her.
Sure.
And that is like those relationships and a little bit of Amanda and Maddie's relationships are kind of what ground you character wise in the book. And then the central like what did Amanda do? What happened to Maddie? Why is she so attached to Ruth? And then why does she become so attached to Imogene is like the main question of the plot.
Okay.
Carl. Why? Well, tell yeah. Thank you for asking. I wasn't going to okay. tell you if you didn't ask.
You were really set. You're setting me up. You set him up. I knock him down. That's
thank you. That's good.
That's how we roll.
So Carl is like kind of a waste, and he feels that he's a waste.
What?
Like he is.
What is a waste to me?
Well, so when he before he leaves for the war, and he's like working on the farm for Maddie's dad. Like he's bad at farming. Like he's
Maddie's
just
daddy.
He's just a bad farmer. He doesn't really get along with Maddie's dad well. Maddie and Amanda's parents die, I think, due to the Spanish flu around the outbreak of World War One.
Okay.
And so then, like, Amanda ends up having to take over a lot of farm stuff and hire this guy, Rudy, to help them. Carl is just feeling, like, kind of restless and ineffectual in... He's not, like... You know, Maddie has died. He has been helping Amanda raise Ruth, but the depression is set in, and she's trying to go back to nursing to help them make any money. And... all the while this is happening, he is like not, he still doesn't know what happened to his wife. And like, he wants to know because he is unsettled. And if maybe he can answer that question, he will like find a role that he feels comfortable in.
Okay.
In the lake cabin, he finds a penknife that has the initials CJO on it, and that like just in his brain he's like, who is that? Who has a knife? What, that's not my wife's initials. I never gave her an initialed knife anyway. That I'm just gonna file this in the back of my brain and be suspicious about it for 15 years until I do something about it. He ends up like looking into some newspaper records, finds that her body was found by Clement Owens, who is the guy who slept with Amanda, who came and did some real estate prospecting.
Right.
He has since built a fancy house in town where his family spends the summers with him. So he's around, which is stressing Amanda out all the time. And Carl starts to think that maybe Maddie slept with this dude, while he was gone. And also, he figures out that Imogene is not is maybe Maddie's daughter, is what he thinks is case. Because the stuff where everybody thinks they're like reminded of her and Amanda's attachment to her starts to, you know, he starts putting that together.
Okay.
Can you guess what the twist upon the twist might be, Andrew? Because
I've
told,
is it based on who somebody's daughter is?
Yes, it is. Because she is not Maddie's daughter.
Uh-huh.
She is Amanda's daughter.
Okay.
By that dude Clement.
Right.
And so because she is unmarried, because she's not in a relationship with this dude, the central incident that undoes their whole thing and leads to Maddie's death is what's going to happen to this kid when Amanda finally gives birth to it.
Okay.
And it's this whole climactic scene that has to do with where the baby's going to stay, and then Maddie passes away. And so Carl ends up like almost killing Clement Owens, chickens out, and then leaves town. And we never like hear from him again.
Great, good.
He gets a job working on a boat because he can't.
You said that the book didn't like deal a lot with specific issues or like stuff of the time.
Sure.
And I'm kind of curious, like how much of this pregnancy and this problem is just treated as a personal thing, and or does the book have anything to say about what women like had to do in that era, or like what their options were, and like tying it to anything more modern. Or it feels the way you're describing it. It just feels like here's a bunch of stuff that happened, and it's not.
It feels.
But I'm just wondering if there's a specific reason, perhaps related to this, why it's happening when it's happening, or what the deal is.
I think, you know, I'd go back first to what Schwartz said, where she was like, I needed a set of circumstances where this thing that Amanda did to keep this pregnancy secret and then come up with a plan to not raise the kid herself made sense, like in the given circumstances.
Oh, okay.
And she does end up doing some heinous stuff. Like, you know, Maddie does die. At least one, if not two other people die over the course of this book. And you're not supposed to know the police are not supposed to know what happened to them. Uh-huh. I don't think you are ever supposed to be like, oh, Amanda is the villain or a bad person, though she is clearly someone who has been shook very, you know, to the core of her being by some of the stuff that's happened to her, and she doesn't know what she can control.
Okay.
And that feels like not particularly specific to this time period in a thematic sense, but it does feel like Amanda feels like a very specific character, if that contrast.
Okay.
Makes sense. Like,
sure.
A thing that I do think thematically ties it to the period is that like stuff and objects and things feel valuable in a way that stood out to me. So,
oh sure.
You know, when the book,
so it was less the era of like everything's collectible, like Funko Pop cluttered
yep.
garbage.
Yep.
And more like the depression is living memory and things are precious. And also American consumerism has not like kicked into full tilt like it does in the post-World War II era.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So Amanda, early on, when you don't know what's happened to Maddie, but you know that Amanda's in charge of Ruth, and like Ruth is being this like kid who can't really handle life, and she like, when she gets a dress dirty, like Amanda like lays into her for it, because it's like, well, that's gonna take me like hours to attempt to clean the one of the five things you own to wear, kind of stuff. There's a story when Amanda's parents are sick and they're dying, or I think it's actually when Maddie and Carl get announced their engagement, but like Amanda drops this crystal vase that her mom had. It's one of the few like nice things her mom had.
Okay.
And later in the book, there's a scene where Ruth and Amanda are washing dishes. And Amanda says, this is like close third person with Amanda, probably she'd break one. She often did, hastily rattling the plates together, paying scant attention to the work. Amanda always felt exhilarated near Ruth's wild energy, even though she cringed at the clumsiness that accompanied it. While Ruth knocked things over right and left, Amanda hadn't lost her grip on a single fragile item since she dropped her mother's crystal vase that day Maddie and Carl were married. There it is. Keeping things whole, she reflected, demanded a great deal of concentration. And like, if there's anything Amanda is about in this book, it is like holding on for dear life to anybody that's important to her, to the point where like they might push her away, they might freak out, they might, you know, not want to be with her. But she is willing to go very, very far to keep something that is important to her. And so the early parts of the book where the stuff that's important are like, one of your few possessions, or a couple of things that you just paid for, so that you can like make more money later, that thematically is like put up against, oh, here is my only sister after my parents died, oh, here is my sister's kid, oh, here is my kid that I'm not supposed to keep, but I don't know what to do without her, kind of stuff.
Sure. Okay.
So that to me is like, I don't know that has to be set in this time period for it to work, but the period is doing some lifting for Schwartz and kind of setting that up.
Okay, that's interesting.
And there's some like more melodramatic stuff around how Amanda handles like what Imogene and Ruth do and don't know, because like Ruth ends up finding out the truth about Imogene, and also Clement Owens is still around and he's a philanderer and he doesn't know that Imogene's his daughter. So like, think about some small town things that might happen there.
Thought you might have said philanthropist.
Nope.
Those are two different things that start with a lot of the same sounds.
His wife is a philanthropist. He is a philanderer. Ain't it always the way?
He gives the gift of fooling around to everybody he meets.
And that stuff does get very melodramatic. There's a lot of like, oh, we have to do everything possible to keep this secret from getting out, and a bunch of people are going to get hurt in the process.
Okay.
And that feels, it's good. It's grip. Like, I was interested to see what happens, but that it's not light, but it doesn't feel revolutionary, you know? It reminds me of plays that I've seen where like, oh yes, the plotting is set up just so that all these characters are making these very difficult decisions where I, the reader, know more than they do. And if only people would just talk to each other.
Sure.
I think that's actually something that the out of order storytelling accomplishes well, where like for the first half of the book has more information than you do. And then for the second half of the book, you usually know one or two more things than the characters do. So you start like watching them do stuff and you're like, oh no.
Yeah, I can find that. I can find that sort of frustrating.
When you know in more fiction than they do?
Like, yeah, just especially if the book like lingers on it for a particularly long time.
Sure, 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 sure. If the whole story starts with a misunderstanding, that to me can be frustrating.
Which is interesting because you like Seinfeld so much. And you've described every Seinfeld.
That's true. There's a lot. Yes. Okay. And I do like the misunderstandings in this book. Like, as I said before, Carl makes an assumption that Maddie was cheating on him rather than assume something that requires a couple more leaps. But Amanda doesn't want to cop to it right away. And then there's another one when Ruth and Imogene are both interested in the same boy. And they have to engineer... Well, Ruth has to engineer a breakup with that boy. And she doesn't even actually know how the boy feels. So like she, there's like misunderstandings there that make it a more painful experience for Ruth than it actually is. And that stuff I think is interesting because it reveals what Schwartz, like she knows, she has some good insight in how people act on what knowledge they have versus like how they would act ideally if they knew everything.
Sure.
And that all kind of seems driven by circumstance. So it was an interesting read. I don't know. I think that's kind of where I'm at.
It's because it sounds like one that would be maybe interesting to read in the moment, but that maybe wouldn't stick with you forever the way, because a lot of those book club books I mentioned earlier have stuck with me in some way. And I don't know, like we do an episode in 6 months, are we going to reference stuff that happened in this book? I don't know if that's the case.
That I don't
but
know.
But I'd be curious to know what you think.
I think some of the imagery of the book and some of the imagery around Amanda in the book is pretty potent. Not that I would necessarily reference it unless another book reminded me of them. Like there's a scene where she meaning Ruth has not learned to swim because her mom died drowning and she almost drowned. Okay, that makes sense. She's playing with some friends. They're trying to teach her to swim, and Amanda is like freaking out that she's doing this because she has explained to Ruth, don't do that. It culminates in like the equivalent of you're going to smoke this whole pack of cigarettes, where Amanda takes Ruth in the boat, like in front of all of her friends, like takes her to the middle of the lake, stands her up and pushes her out of the boat. And you're like reading this going, you love this person. What are you doing? And there's another boat mishap that happens later in the book that is pretty like, oh God, did that just happen? So there's stuff throughout that image-wise and scene-wise will stick with me for a little while, though I don't know that it's like it's tied to heavy themes necessarily. And I don't know that because it's not, as we said, it's not like trying to illuminate parts of the time period in a new way. Like it's not trying to re-examine or really dive into a certain type of person from the 1920s through early 40s. I don't think I'm going to reference it later if we like hit this time period again.
Or, sure. Okay.
You know, maybe I will. I don't know. I feel
and I'm not saying that's a measure of whether a book is successful or not.
Yeah.
I just know that having done this for 6 years at this point, there are just some books that come up as touchstones over and over again, and some that don't. And I'm just interested. I'm interested in discussing like why that
yes.
separation exists.
I do think for folks who have read this book and it stuck with them. Particularly maybe women readers, like the different types of female relationships in this book, both between like a number of characters and the different ways in which like Ruth and Amanda are both sisters, friends, a mother and daughter relationship, the parallels between the different sister relationships. Those are all pretty rich and complex in a way that not, you know, you don't always get, especially in like certain types of historical fiction. So that's a thing that might just like ring true with a lot of people.
Yeah.
That it does not speak to my sibling experience, so might not ring true for me. That is going to make it stand out later.
Well, and if you're, and I'm not trying to bring this up to go off Franzen, but if you're thinking about.
Yeah.
Oprah's.
Yeah, go full Franzen.
If you're thinking about Oprah's demo, then yeah, a lot of these themes about abuse and family and motherhood and sisterhood is probably just hitting you on a different level than it would hit one of us, which is, you know, I always try to keep that in mind when I'm reading stuff from perspectives different from my own, but yeah, just thinking it through.
Yeah. And I think that's the book. Drowning Ruth. Check it out, I guess.
Yeah.
Pull your tooth out and trade it for a marble.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Do you have any information about where I might talk to a good podcast online?
Yeah, I think. Do you want to send an email?
Can I borrow a cup of social media?
Great. Well, let me reach in the back of my cupboard. I have an email address. I have overduepod@gmail.com. Does that help?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, email's canceled.
I have a Facebook.
Because of the Russia.
I have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/overduepod. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, that's more like what I want to do.
What about Twitter, the best one? twitter.com/overduepod.
Oh, this one is very, I think this one has been on the shelf for a little too long. It's kind
of
stinky.
Yeah, well, lots of people are still using it, including Adam, Amber, Raul, Erica, Holly, Ben, Sean, Cheryl, Lauren, Christopher, Stephanie, Danny, and many more, Andrew, folks who have reached out to us in the past week. Thank you so much. Andrew, now that I've given you the social media, can you give me a website to find out more about this good podcast?
Mm-hmm. Overduepodcast.com is one.
Yep.
That I know about. And if you go there, you can find links to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and our RSS feed. You can read more about the show. You can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/overduepod. You can see the books that we have read and that we're going to read. We're going to finalize June's schedule. Probably by the time you are hearing this, we will have figured it out.
Yeah.
And we'll be putting up on our site and our social feed soon. And, also look out later this week for the thrilling conclusion of Stop Homer Time,
woo,
where we discuss book 24 of Emily Wilson's translation on the Odyssey and our closing thoughts Homer's epic.
And then we'll be starting up Hellboys after that. Go to patreon.com/overduepod to find out how you can get your Hellboys early. And then they'll start hitting the main feed, our Divine Comedy podcasts are hitting the main feed sometime in July. Check that out.
All right. Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week. And until then, try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.